Okay, Shavua Tov, everybody. Welcome. It's a little bit different than our usual annual shiur. It's much harder to present, and I have so much more respect, especially since nobody here has a screen on. I feel like I should just record myself and play it here for everybody else. But it's my... hi, Jerry. Thank you. Okay, so in starting, you know, I try to align as many ideas as possible just with the current matzav, the current situation, just because I feel like that's more relevant and meaningful and, you know, still have ideas that are new, maybe one or two from the past with a new twist. But that's basically what I was going for this year. So let's start just an addendum, I guess you could call it. I think I put it on the cheat sheet. You know, because this year many families are unable to be together for the Seder, parents and children, friends and other extended family, it's difficult to, so to speak, be alone. And so I just had a few ideas, some we've sort of shared before a few years ago in terms of creating moments at the Seder, but just run through these quickly of things that you could do just to try and bridge that gap and that distance. So first of all, I'd mentioned a few years ago, we try to do this every year now, printing out pictures of some of those family members that can't be with you at the Seder this year and have them at the table with you. The kids can look at them. You can look at them, sort of remember, set up picture frames, recommend for those family members or friends that can't come to do the same. That's number one. Number two, have a family or friend interview. You could empower your kids, by the way, to do a lot of these things if they're old enough. I had my kids do this last week. It was very successful. They had to come up with some questions to ask their grandparents or great-grandparents. Some of them were mundane, like your favorite color, your favorite teacher, what subject they taught, why, their favorite friend growing up, what's your favorite Pesach song, what's your favorite food. But this way, it sort of creates that connection with the family that's not able to be here, and then they could share those answers at the Seder or before the Seder. That bridges the distance. I saw this idea online. I don't remember where I saw this, so I can't give credit. But it was a Dayenu thank you. And basically, you make a list of 10 things that you're thankful for a specific family member. And you write those down. And then you list them in the style of Dayenu. You know, it would have been enough if my mother made great chocolate chip cookies, but wasn't able to bring them to the Seder. And if she was able to bring them to the Seder, but everybody else ate them and I didn't get to get one, Dayenu, Vechule, like that kind of thing. I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily flow, but it just shows a sense of appreciation centered around the theme of Pesach, which they can then share with those family members that aren't there. And finally, maybe this is obvious, but you on Erev Pesach or even on Chol Moed, to have a Zoom with all the family that usually gets together, or even just a video chat, and even just for 15 minutes, just to sing through the family tunes of the Pesach songs together, that could also bring a little bit of comfort and nostalgia that we'll be missing this year. Okay, so that's the addendum. Now to the Torah. So we have in number one, Halach Ma'anya. Now this is an idea we shared, I want to say maybe 6 years ago. And the following question comes up. I think Aaron mentioned it earlier this week, which is we say in Halach Ma'anya, whoever needs can come basically. You're making an invitation to whoever needs to come for a meal to come join you for the meal, come join you for the Pesach Seder. And the question that we've asked in the past is, why now? It seems kind of too late to offer, you know, this invitation now. Your meal, it's too late to offer that. But Aaron, I think, mentioned Rav Nevensal, you know, people were asking him, maybe we shouldn't even say that this year because we can invite people. It's against the law to invite people to join us. Or maybe it's against federal suggestions because it's dangerous for certain family members. And so we can't invite people to come join us at the Seder. But I think that maybe we could give the following explanation, which has meaning specifically this year. And that is, Rav Soloveitchik in the Night That Unites Haggadah. That's this Haggadah here. He says about Avram Avinu that Avram welcomed guests. He welcomed all kinds of guests, but he didn't just welcome them. He welcomed them and had a sort of an openness to who they were and didn't hold that with them. And so basically the idea being here is that this year we can welcome new ideas to the Seder. Meaning we can't invite people, but we can welcome and invite new ideas. And so just one example of that, of being open to new ideas, is I saw Elisha Nachamovitz, who I think is Jewish, at least he sounds Jewish. So he was a man in France that, you know, they're in lockdown as well, and he wanted to run a marathon. This, John, this is a shout out to you, John Kowal. And so he decided to run a marathon on his balcony, on his porch balcony. And he ran that back and forth. I think it said it was maybe 7 meters long. Back and forth he went. And it took him a lot longer, 6.5 hours. But he ran a marathon on his porch balcony. And so people might say, oh, I'm in lockdown. I can't go more than 100 meters. How can I run a marathon? How can I do it? But if we're open to new ideas and we can sort of look beyond our rigidity, that's a word, of where we are in the situation that we're in, then we can be open to other possibilities. So, you know, maybe on a lighter note, if you've always sung a certain tune because you're with your in-laws and they always sing a certain tune and you want to sing your family's tune this year, so sing your family's tune. Or if you always sing your family's tune and your wife wants to sing her family's tune this year, so sing both. Be open to new ideas. But more seriously, maybe if we're able to be less judgmental of others, regardless of the segment that they come from, we can look beyond and look from their perspective, even if we don't necessarily agree, but at least to look beyond to be able to welcome in that new idea and foster achdus. By doing so, Bezra Hashem, next year we'll be able, and in the future, to physically once again invite people to our Seder. Okay, idea number two. Rav Avram Shur says in his Sefer Halakha Chvalibuv, I think I saw this from Rav Ephraim Goldberg, he says, we say every year Manishtana, but, you know, what does Manishtana mean? Literally, it means, why is it, right? Well, how do we read this? Why is this night different from every other night, right? That's how we would translate it. What makes this night different from every other night? But he says, don't read it like that, but rather read it Manishtana al yidei halayla hazeh. What will be different because of this night? Meaning, not what is different, but what will be different because I've experienced the Seder night. That's why I'd like to call, what's your Seder resolution? Okay? Meaning, what will I do differently now? How will I be changed after experiencing the Seder night? Right? Just like so many years ago when we experienced Yitziat Mitzrayim, it was a great change that was affected because of that. It created a nation. So tonight also shouldn't just be another family meal. I mean, it's great that the family gets together, but it should be one where Chayv Adam Laharos, it's Asmo Kilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim, where we really, literally, are reliving and experiencing the Yitzia Mitzrayim and have that wow moment that we say, you know, I want to make a resolution that I want to, you know, do X, Y, or Z. Maybe it's to share more Divrei Torah in general or at meals like we do at the Seder. Or maybe it's to sing more songs on Shabbos and have the feel and specialness of Shabbos like we sing at the Seder many of the songs. Or maybe it's to be more involved in interacting with our children like we try to do on Pesach. So to each their own, whatever it is. But remember, Manishtana is not only what is different about tonight, but how will we be different and change after experiencing the Seder? What is our Seder resolution? On to number three. Baruch HaMakom, we say Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shanasan Torah Lama Yisrael, Baruch Hu, Keneged Arba Banin Dibra Torah, Echad Chacham, Echad Rasha, Echad Tam, Echad Shein Delisho. Right? We bless Hashem, we say, Blessed are you, Hashem, and the four sons. So two questions here. I think we've asked these before, but we're going to offer different answers more relevant to today's situation. So first of all, why this strange name of Hamakom for for Hashem, right? Why not any other name of Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, of Elohim, of Kael? Any of these names are much more commonly used. So why Hamakom being used here? And second of all, why do we say Echad in front of each of the children? Echad Chacham, the Echad Rasha. Why that Echad, that one? So Hashem, Hamakom, is to remind us that Hashem is here. Right, Hashem is here. Hashem is there. Hashem is truly everywhere. Right, he Hashem is bekol makom. He's in every place, up, up, down, down. Right, that's right, Jerry. Very good. You know the song. Right, Hashem is in every place. He's bekol makom, regardless of where we are. You know, I would have said in the past, what does this mean that he's in every place? Means that regardless of where we are in the world, he's at every single seder. Right, he's all over the world, or regardless of where the place they are holding spiritually. Hashem is with them at their Seder. But I think that this year I'd like to suggest something a little bit differently, which I saw Rav Shimon Schwab says. He has this in the back of his Sefer on Tefillah. This is the English one. He has ideas on the Haggadah in the back there. So let me just read to you what Rav Schwab says. He says, before beginning the section dealing with the Arba Banim, The Baal Haggadah too envisions people who may be sitting at their Seder tables in circumstances that are less than happy. This may be because Hashem has not blessed them yet with children, and they're there without a child to ask Manishtana, no one with whom to be Mekayim to fulfill the mitzvah of Vihigata Levincha that you should teach and tell your child the story of Mitzrayim. In such circumstances, one is to be accepting of God's judgment when he says the words Baruch Hamakom, Baruch Hu, with which he accepts the will of Hashem in not granting him children yet. This resonates even more so this year, right? Where many of us will be unfortunately unable to have Seder together with parents, with children, with grandchildren, can't get together with extended family members or with friends, all alone, all because of Corona. So to that, we read Hamakom, that we understand that this is Hashem's will for this year, for whatever reason we don't understand, and that we show him that we accept it by still moving forward and going ahead and still having the Seder, even though it's not the ideal. So that's to answer the first question, Hamakom. And something I left out here, he points out, when do we say Hamakom? We say Hamakom. There's two other places where we say Hamakom, Hashem's name like that. Hamakom Yinachem Etchem, by a mourner, the greetings, the consolation that we give to a mourner, that Hashem should give you comfort. And Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem. We say every Monday and Thursday, after Torah reading, we say Achenu Kol Beis Yisrael Hanasim Batsara, that are our Jewish brethren that are in distress. Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem, that Hashem, Hamakom, Hashem should have mercy on them. So these allusions of Hamakom, the name of Hamakom being referenced, of Hashem being referenced, are places where we want Hashem, we understand that this is the will of Hashem, and we ask him to sort of have mercy on us. But even more than that, or I guess I could say building on that, so why did it say Echad Chacham, Echad Rasha? So I'd say it's to remind us that it doesn't matter if you're the Chacham and you're by yourself. Echad Chacham, you're one, you're alone, you're by yourself. Echad Rasha, or you're alone. Each child is alone. They can't be with the rest of the family. They're Echad. So remember what we just said, that Baruch HaMakom, that we're blessed and we bless Hashem, that he's in all places and spaces and with us. And so that should be the first level of, I guess, comfort, is reminding us that we're not alone, that Hashem is with us. But we also say, what do we say after that? Baruch Shanasan Torah Lamo Yisrael Baruch Hu. We say that Hashem blesses Hashem who gave us the Torah. So if you say, you know what, it's great Hashem's with me, but I still feel alone. So Hashem says, don't worry, because I also gave you the Torah to be with you. Right? The Torah is like, it's like a friend. It's like having somebody with you to be able to learn and keep your mind in the Torah, in all the learnings of all the generations over the year, you don't feel so alone anymore. You have all the Tanoim and Amorim and Rishonim and Achronim all there with you when you're learning. Ezra Soloveitchik often would reference when teaching that he'd say, it feels like the Rashba and the Ritva and Rabbeinu Tam, they're all here with us in the room. And so Hashem is saying, you know what, I know it's not the same, but it's a little bit, it could help to negate that loneliness, to know that you have something to learn to keep you company. But if you say to me, Naftali, you know what, it still doesn't cut it, I still feel alone. So let me share with you one last idea here, a beautiful idea that I heard from Rabbi J.J. Schachter. And this idea he heard from his predecessor at the Jewish Center, Shul in New York City, from Rabbi Isaac Bernstein. When we go to a mourner and we comfort them and we say, Hamakom Yenachem Eschem. So we translate it before as Hashem, Hamakom, Hashem should comfort you. But he says, you know what Hamakom means? That place in your heart, Hamakom, that place in your heart where you have all the memories of the person that just passed away, of your loved one that's not here with you. Yinachem etchem. Those memories in your heart, in that place in your heart, that should bring you a comfort. And so, at the Seder night, we might be alone, we might not be able to be with our family, with our friends, with our extended family, with our parents and grandparents or children. But at the very least, if we can't move on and remind ourselves that this is Hashem's will, or remember that we're not alone, Hashem is with us, or remember that we have the Torah with us to keep us company, at the very least we can have the memories of the past Seders that we've had with them, and I'd say the imagination memories of future Sedarim Bezra Hashem that we'll be able to have with them. Okay, moving on to number four. V'hi she'amda. Feel like breaking out into Shweki's song. Okay, so I saw a few months ago, Sivan Rahav Meir posted a short story, I guess, a story, something that a soldier had sent her, Ayel Shmueli. He was sent, I guess, Shlichut. He went on a trip after being in the army for 8 years in an elite unit, and he went on a trip to Toronto. And he said when he got there, he went Shabbos morning to Shul, and for the first time in his life, suddenly he hears them making the Mishaberach for the Chaylei Tzahal, for the soldiers, the prayer for the soldiers of the Israeli Defense Force. For 8 years, he'd been in the army and didn't know that every Shabbos, and Jews all over the world are thinking and davening and praying on his behalf to protect him. And he says that was one of the most meaningful and moving moments of his life. And so this idea, is when I saw it, immediately reminded me of an explanation for V'hi she'amda, which, I think I shared this several years ago, but this story reminded me of it. The Brisker Rav says, I don't understand, we say, B'chol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu, that every generation, there's always somebody that stands up against us, that persecutes us, that hates us, that tries to kill us. And it's not true, because there are generations where we have relative calm, where the Jews are able to live somewhat peacefully with those that they, the non-Jews around them. So how can you say in every single generation, Omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu, that they always stand up against us to destroy us, to hurt us? And he explained that we may not know what's going on. We may not know about the plans that they have to hurt us, to do terrorist attacks against us, but they're always there behind the scenes. And sometimes Hashem just makes sure that we're protected. V'akadosh Baruch Hu matzilin miyadam, that Hashem protects us and saves us. And that's like that soldier that didn't realize that every single Shabbos, the Jews around the world are praying on his behalf, protecting him, going on behind the scenes. And just to connect this one last idea on this, The Chassam Sofer says on Parshas Balak, why is it that we have a Parsha dedicated to a non-Jew? Balak, it's named after a non-Jew. Most of the Parsha talks about the non-Jews. Why would we even include that in our list of Parshas? Why was it so important for Hashem to include that and teach it to us? And the Chassam Sofer explains, it's because Hashem wanted us to realize that there's always another story going on, so to speak, outside of our lives, that we don't even realize that there's a whole non-Jewish nation that wanted to destroy us. And behind the scenes, Hashem works it out that instead of Bilam cursing the Jews, that Bilam is blessing the Jews and Hashem is protecting us. And so that's the Mishaberach L'Chayalim, and that's the Chol Dor V'Dor Omdim Aleinu, but really, even if we don't realize it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Miyada. Okay, number five. We say, We say Vayisham Legoy Gadol, something like that. Vayisham Legoy Gadol. What does that mean? Hayisrael Mitsuyanim Sham. That the Jewish people were Mitsuyanim Sham, which will translate as outstanding, meaning unique. That they distinguished themselves there. And we've said before in the past that the Medrash says what made them outstanding. That they didn't change their clothing, they didn't change their language, and they didn't change their names. They kept Jewish names. So we'll come back to that in a minute. But just focusing on the word Mitsuyanim, so the Ben Ish Chai, I saw this was very interesting, the Ben Ish Chai says, the Gemara in Sota tells us that the Jewish mothers who were afraid of their sons being killed would go out into the fields to have the children, and they would just leave the babies there so that Hashem or the Malachim could take care of them till they were older and it was safe for them to come back. So the Ben Ish Chai says, if you have this whole field of babies out there, how are they going to know which one is their child? Right? It's like in the maternity ward, the baby's getting mixed up at birth, and then, you know, who knows which one is your baby? So what did they do? The Ben Ish Chai says that each child's face was mitsuyanim. It was distinct. It was unique in that it looked just like Avraham and Yitzchak. Yitzchak's face looked exactly like Avraham's. So too, every single child's face looked like their father. And that's what it means that they were distinct, that they were mitsuyanim. And he says that you see that because a mitsuyanim sham, Sham you can read as some, like a siman. There was a mitsuyanim some, that on their faces it was like a siman, that was unique. Okay, but going back to the names, so why was the fact that they didn't change their names such a monumental reason to merit Geula? You know, like not changing your clothing. So, I mean, you know, okay, fine. So that identifies you with a specific team or with specific country or culture or even a language, you know, identifies you. But those are things that very easily can be changed, right? You could take off your clothing. You'd be a fair weather fan and all of a sudden now put on the winning team's jersey because they're winning. Or you could learn many languages. You're not bound to one specific language. So those things are not as distinct, but a name, think about it. A name is something that once you have it, for the most part, you don't change it, right? That's your name. Maybe on a rare occasion, Alpi Kabbalah, the person felt that it wasn't the right name, and so they give the person a completely different name. I'm not talking about adding names to a name, but like completely change the name. That's very rare. A name is something that anchors you, and it gives you identity. And okay, so let me share with you a story. A couple of you might have heard the story at Kilati a few months ago that I shared, but I think most of the people here looking around did not hear the story yet, and for all those that are going to listen to the recording. So let me share this following story with you. David Mandel is the CEO of OHEL Child Family Services in New York, and he shared the following story. One time he was at a convention, a conference, with a bunch of teenage foster children. And he got up there on Shabbos. He had a group with them. He was leading a group. And he said to them, imagine that you could have one wish. You could wish for anything you want in the world. What would you wish for? And so there was one girl that got up there. She stood up, 15-year-old girl. And she said, I wish I had a name tag. So he's looking at her, you know, very strange wish. You could wish for anything in the world and you wish for a name tag. What's going on? So she sees that he looks a little perplexed and she explains to him, for the last 15 years of my life, every 2 or 3 years, I would move around to a new family and I would get a new name. I want my own name tag. I want to have a name that is mine and that is permanent and that gives me an identity. And that's what a name is. A name gives us an identity, gives us a sense of purpose. A lot of times the name bound within the name are attributes that the person will then carry out. But even more than that, I think that the name is something within let me share with you something Rav Avadya Yosef said. He often would bemoan the fact that people would refer by their secular names as opposed to their Jewish name. And I don't know if this was him or just in the Sephardic Heritage Haggadah, that says tongue in cheek, Keshem Shenichnas Lebris, Keni Kanes Latorah Lechup Lamasim Tovim. We say that when a baby's born, but you can play on words that Keshem Shenichnas Lebris, that same name that you're given at the bris, it shouldn't just be a one-time thing, that Jewish name that you're given as a baby, but it should be something that you carry with you throughout life, throughout the rest of your life, as something that you're proud of and that gives you a sense of identity and shows us who you are. And, okay, fine. Let's leave that as that, and let's move on to the next one. Vayanunu. This happens to be one of my children's favorite words in the Haggadah, Vayanunu. Also was my sister's favorite part of the Haggadah growing up, Vayanunu, just because it sounds so funny. Vayanunu. So it says, Vayanunu, 2:22. 1 second. Vayanunu. It says that they oppress them. K'moshen amar vayasimu alav sarei misim l'man anaso b'siv lo sam. They place taskmasters over them in order to oppress them with their burdens. Okay, b'siv lo sam, meaning oppressing them with their burdens. So, and that's the way I think most people would probably translate it. If you look in the English translations of most Haggadahs, they would translate siv lo sam as burdens or as afflictions. So Rav Menachem Mendel Zaks, who is the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim, he explained that Siv Lo Tzam is also the same shoresh as savlanut, as patience, having patience. I saw Rav Dessler, I think, also says this idea. I didn't see that inside, so I can't say for sure, but I think I saw a reference that he says the same idea. So savlanut, patience. So what does that mean, patience? Meaning, I would have thought that patience is a positive attribute, right? That you tell your kids, come on, have, or somebody that can't wait, you know, have patience, right? If you have patience, then you're a good person that you were able to wait. But here it sounds like something which is negative, that the Egyptians are putting on the Jewish people, the siv lo sam. And in fact, it also says in the pasuk, that Hashem says, I will take you out from under the sivlos mitzrayim, right? So what could be burden or afflictions, but Rav Menachem Mendel Zaks says in his Sefer Menachem Sion, I'm going to take you out from the savlanut. What does that mean? That the Jewish people weren't ready for the redemption because they were able to tolerate the conditions, meaning it didn't bother them enough, this thing that the Egyptians were doing to them. They said, okay, fine. All right, we'll work for free. Okay, fine. So we have to stay in the work for all day, all night. We can't see our families. All right, fine. Eventually it'll get better. Okay, fine. We have to build all these bricks and we don't have the tools for it and the proper materials. Fine. Okay, we'll deal with it. Okay, we won't say anything. No, that's the problem. That's what Hashem says. I'm going to take you out mitachas divlos Mitzrayim because of this mitachas, because of this savlanut, because of this patience that you have, that it doesn't bother you enough to even call out to me. And therefore, that is why I need to take you out, because you have this savlanut. So here savlanut is being referred to as a negative thing, that they were so apathetic and that they weren't calling out to Hashem. And so the message for us is, I think with everything going on because of the coronavirus, that it's sort of forced us into a corner. And we could have just given up, raised our hands and said, okay, fine, so we won't daven with a minyan, fine, so we'll be able to still, for some of us, maybe work from home, maybe have schooling from home, maybe this and that. But no, it's been such a beautiful thing, the outpouring of shiurim online, the outpouring of extra tefillah and the extra achdus that I've seen between some organizations that I never in 100 years would have imagined seeing their name on the same letterhead, coming together in tefillah and in crying out to Hashem that this is not what we want and we want you to stop it and we will not have patience anymore for this plague, and we hope and pray that you will help us remove it. And that's the Sivlo Sama Mitzrayim, not the affliction, but that we no longer have patience and we want this affliction removed. Number 7, Makas Choshech. Okay, so I think most of us, if I asked you what was Makas Choshech, you probably would say to me, you know, like we learned from kindergarten, Makas Choshech is that Hashem made it wherever the Egyptians were, that it was dark outside, it was like it was night, and wherever the Jews were, it was daylight. And that was Makas Choshech, right? Right. But the Torah Tamima says something incredible. I mean, it's complete. He says, if I even have the, I guess this is how you translate it, if I even have Lule Mistafina Lohutzi Davar Chadash Ma'od, if I would even have the, I guess you'd say, audacity to suggest something so novel, a novel interpretation. But he has questions, he has problems and difficulties based on the normal understanding that it was dark and night outside for the Egyptians and daylight for the Jews, and that this darkness for the Egyptians lasted perpetually, so to speak, for the 6 days. So instead, this is what he suggests. He suggests that for the Egyptians, that there, it was almost like a cataract that came over each of the Egyptians' eyes, meaning it was still daylight outside for all of Egypt, including in Mitzrayim, in the part of Mitzrayim where the Egyptians live. But for each and every individual Egyptian, it was like the wool pulled over their eyes, like a cataract, like darkness in their eyes. And the language he uses is rak be'enei ha'anashim, that it was only in their eyes. And this made me think, you know, perhaps al pidrush, Be'enei Mitzrayim, you could say that it was almost like in their perception. I mean, yes, that there was this physical cataract, but it was Be'enei Mitzrayim, that it was almost like their perception was one of darkness, because really outside it was light. And when I saw this, it made me think of Dennis Prager's broken tile syndrome. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this concept, but basically what he says is that, you know, if you walk into an office building, into an office, you go to the dentist, and you're looking around, sitting there in the waiting room, looking at the magazines on the table, you're looking around, and almost immediately, the first thing that you will notice is that one tile up on the ceiling that's chipped or broken or had a leak and is miscolored or whatever. And he says that you know, why do we have this tendency to always navigate and focus on the negative, on the bad, on the broken tile, on the darkness? And if instead of noticing the darkness, right, that was the mitzrim, al-pidrush, you could say, you know, the Torah Tumima says it was like a cataract over their eye, but it was rak be'ein neha nashim, perhaps al-pidrush, it was in their own perception, they were only able to see the darkness and not able to see the light because they had that broken tile syndrome. So, yes, right now we might be in isolation. We might be by ourselves. We might have lost our jobs. We might be going crazy with the kids home or everybody on top of each other not being able to get outside. But let's not focus on the negative. And instead, let's focus on the good and the light. That we do have technology that's able to keep us connected and able to continue learning shiurim and can be able for some people to continue working. And for some kids, maybe to be able to continue school a little bit. But, you know, 100 years ago when they had the Spanish flu, they were probably really alone. They felt really alone because they didn't have this technology. Even the technology of medicine that we have today, we may not have a vaccine, but the ability for people to be kept on respirators has enabled so many more to recover from this. Let's be thankful that we have a roof over our heads and that we don't live outside. Or that we have more time to spend with our children and our family at home, even if it is a little bit more stressful. So that's Makas Choshech. When we read about Makas Choshech, let us remember to focus on not on the broken tile, but to look outside and see beyond that darkness over our eyes that might be clouding our eyes and be able to see that really there is a light at the end of the tunnel outside. Number 8. Dayenu. Okay, so this year, I actually shared this idea in honor of my great aunt Happy, who it's her 85th birthday, and I share this in her honor. Now, Dayenu is you know it's highly anticipated. It's fun. It's a widely known song, but when we look at this 15 line acrostic more closely. So several questions come up. First of all, just open up Dayenu. Probably open up the non-Sephardic one in case there's any differences there. First of all, it seems kind of strange because how can we say, you know, Hashem, if you had split the sea, but you hadn't taken us through it, right? We say, Ivu karalanu es hayam v'lo hevi ranu b'sochu b'charava. If you would have split the sea but not brought us through it, it would have been enough. Really? If we hadn't been able to get through it, then fine. Oh, look at that sea that split. That's really nice. Boom, the Egyptians kill us. Game over. Right? Doesn't seem like it would have been enough. Or let's say we say, if you would have taken care of our needs in the desert but not given us man, Dayen, it would have been enough. Really? If we didn't have the man, then I don't know if we would have had food. So maybe we've taken care of our needs in general, but without food, we wouldn't have been able to survive. So maybe, how can you say Dayenu? So that's question number one. Number two is, if you analyze the structure of Dayenu, so you might note that it's somewhat unique. Professor Meir Bar-Ilan points out that Dayenu is written as a concatenation. Yes, I looked that word up. I did not know that word. Which means that the beginning of every line mirrors the end of the previous line, which in Hebrew is called Shir Shor. And he references several works of Aaron Mirsky, who's a noted researcher with trying to connect liturgy and midrash. And he tried to find some kind of precedent in Tanakh or in the Tanaim using this, exhibiting some allusions to this motto. But Dayenu seems to be unique, that this is the only one where the whole second half of the stanza of the line is always the beginning, the whole beginning part of the next line. And so that's the second question. Why was Dayenu written in this unusual arrangement? So the Gemara in Brachos asks, what does it mean, Ein Sur Kelokeinu? Some of you may have heard me share this at Ariel Cutler's Shalom Zachar a few months ago. So what does it mean, Ein Sur Kelokeinu, that there's no rock like our God? So the Gemara says, Ein Sayar Kelokeinu, that there's no painter, no artist like Hashem. So it's just strange. Why is the Gemara comparing Hashem to an artist? Like, why would you take the pshat of the pasuk, tsur, rock, and turn it into tsayar, into an artist? So Rav Simcha Zissel Broida suggests what the Gemara is trying to convey is the idea that Hashem's intervention in this world is like an artist painting a painting. And when the artist starts painting, I've seen this before with my daughter who enjoys painting. You know, they start painting and they paint the whole canvas black. You're like, what are you doing with this? And then all of a sudden there's a little bit of, you know, white over here. And you have no idea where they're going with this. But with each brushstroke, we're more and more confused. So similarly, Hashem, we don't understand what he's doing. We don't understand the big picture. And sometimes it may take years to understand, but Hashem knows from the beginning where he's trying to get at the end with his picture. So each line of Dayenu, you know, might initially be perceived as an isolated act of Hashem. And at that moment, it might seem perplexing. Why is Hashem doing A, but not B? And you know, it doesn't seem like it would have been enough if he only did A. But perhaps that's the interconnectedness of Dayenu. That's teaching us with this sheer shore, with this concatenation, this interconnectedness, that there is a bigger picture. And that Hashem is the master artist and knows why things have to happen in a certain order, in a certain way. So that's what we're thanking Hashem, saying Dayenu. We're thanking Hashem each step of the way to recognize we may not understand, but we have faith in you. And if it's good enough for you, Hashem, then Dayenu, it's good enough for us. And so perhaps that's also why we repeat it all again in the next paragraph. That also always bothered me, why we repeat that at the end. And then we go ahead and read all 15 in one paragraph again. Like, why do we need to do that? So when I think, perhaps based on what we just said, when we experienced all those blessings the first time from Hashem, so we couldn't see the interconnectedness. It was just 15 individual and isolated events and stanzas. But now looking back, we can read it through as one straight story because now we see how it's all connected. So that and that's really at the Seder, that's what we're doing. The interconnectedness, the sharing songs, family songs that we sing every year, sharing the Seder together with family and different generations. It's a generational, intergenerational, interconnectedness event, which unfortunately we won't be able to celebrate together this year. But let me just share a short story from Rav Kook that perhaps can give us comfort. In 1924, Rav Kook went to America to do fundraising. And when he went, before he left, he took two stones, two little pebbles from the land of Israel, stuck it in his pocket. And periodically, regularly, when he was in America, he would feel there for those stones from Israel as a constant reminder and to keep him grounded, so to speak, literally, figuratively and literally, to the land to which he yearned to return. And so this year, where we may be alone at the Seder, we may not have that intergenerational connectedness. When we sing Dayenu and when we sing all the songs and tell the stories and do the, you know, unique family things that every family has at their Seder, we can, so to speak, feel those pebbles in our pocket, those memories, that hamakom yinachem eschem, those memories in our heart from past Sedarim, and at least have that to connect us, to get us through to next year. Number 9, Pesach. This is a short one. So we say Pesach, right? If I asked you, how would you translate Pesach, you would tell me, you're all muted, so you can't. Pesach is Passover, right? Hashem passed over the Jewish houses. Vespotenu Hitzil, and he saved our houses. But Rav Schwab says, don't read it Pesach, but rather Piseach, a lame person. That Hashem, Lahavdil, was like a lame person. A lame person's like the old man with the cane, you know, walking very slowly as he goes by. And so Hashem was like that old person, not passing over, but so to speak, hovering over the houses of the Jewish people to protect us. And it just gives such a different description of Hashem. Not that he passed over, you know, in this vengeful kind of destroy all the Egyptians, destroy everybody out there. If you're not, if you didn't cover your house in blood and you didn't do like I said, then the destruction, destruction, destruction. but rather a God of compassion and protection. And that's what the Piseach, Hashem Piseach, not that he passed over, but that he hovered over us, so to speak, protecting us. Okay, and finally, number 10, Koshel Eliyahu. So we'll end here with a, try and end here with a story, as I try to always do. So Koshel Eliyahu. One second. Ah, okay. So why do we have a Koshel Eliyahu? Why not call it a Koshel Mashiach, right? This is talking about the Geula. These are all the Halil Nirtza, the songs of looking ahead towards the Geula, the times of Mashiach. So let's call it Koshel Mashiach, right? So number one, what's so special about Eliyahu that it's a Koshel Eliyahu and not Mashiach? And number two is, why do we even need this Kosh Bichlal? I mean, it seems like such a waste to fill it up. I mean, I remember I had a friend who, at their Sheva Brachos, his father-in-law had this huge, huge kos. I think it was the family's Koshel Eliyahu, I'm not sure. In any event, this cup was so big, it took almost a whole bottle of wine to fill it up. That was how big it is. You drink that, Jerry, you're out for the count, you know? So, it seems like such a waste to fill up the Koshel Eliyahu. Why do we fill it up and not even drink it? So let me share with you a story, and then we'll answer this. So Rabbi Benjamin Blech, who's an educator and mechanech and Rav par excellence, and many of you probably read his writings on Eish.com or heard him speak. He's excellent, excellent. I think my father said he was one of his favorite teachers. Growing up, when he was in, he had him at YU 1 year. So, Rabbi Blech, at his 80th birthday party at YU, they had a special birthday party for him. And he told the following story, which is just such a wow, powerful story. Listen to this. He said, years ago, there was a member of the Knesset when Menachem Begin was the prime minister. And the minister's name was
Shmuel Tamir.
At that time in Israel, it was very difficult. It was a very difficult economic time, and wanted to try and make sure that Israel's population sort of was more diminished, so that it wasn't as much of a strain on the resources, you know, in terms of food and facilities in Israel. So he wanted to try and get abortion to be permitted. So he went to Rav Aryeh Levin, and he spoke to him about this. He said, you know, I don't understand how you can permit bringing children into a world like this where they can't be taken properly, be taken care of properly. So I think you should really rethink your position that abortion is prohibited. So Rav Aryeh Levin said to him, you know, it's very interesting that you should bring that up. Let me tell you a story. Many years ago, there was a couple that came to me with this exact same question. It was a young husband and wife, mother and father. They had one child, young child already. The father was going to school, the mother was in school, and she became pregnant again. And they didn't know if they'd be able to manage. And so they came to me and said, would it be permissible in this case to have an abortion? So I said to them that it's completely forbidden. And I explained to them, first of all, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of having children, you have to have not just one child, but you have to have both a male and a female to fulfill that. Second of all, the fact that you're afraid that you won't be able to feed your child, we have to have emunah in Hashem that Hashem will provide for us. But third of all, if you're pregnant already, the neshama that you created, and that neshama already has a mission in life. And that mission can't be performed by anybody else. And therefore, you have to let this child live. So now Shmuel says to Rav Levin, well, did they listen to you? So Rav Levin says, yes, they did. And Shmuel says, and did that child, mockingly, did that child fulfill their mission in life? And Rav Levin says to him, well, you'll have to answer that question for me. Because the people who came to me years ago were your parents. And you are the child that lived because I gave that psak. Boom! Right, drop the mic right there. Right, wow, what a powerful story. So, who was Eliyahu? Eliyahu, this is Eliyahu, the Eliyahu that comes to the Seder, this is the Eliyahu who got the Jewish people to do tshuva on Har HaKarmel when he was up against all the Nevi'ei Baal, the false prophets of Baal. And the Jews did do tshuva, right? Hashem hu ha'elokim, Hashem hu ha'elokim. But this is also the Eliyahu who had spoken badly about the Jews, that they weren't following Hashem, and therefore he has to go around every year to the Seder to see that the Jews are keeping following Hashem, and go to every bris and see that the Jews, even many unaffiliated, are giving their son a bris. And see, so he sees that they are doing some mitzvos. But Hashem says, you know what your life mission is now, Eliyahu? Your life mission is to go around and check every single year and see if they've done full tshuva. And if they're ready to, then you announce that it's time for Mashiach to come. As it says in Malachi, Hine Anochi Sholeach Lachem Es Eliyahu HaNavi. Behold, I'm sending to you, before you, Eliyahu HaNavi, Lifnei Bo Yom Hashem HaGadol VaAnor, before the great day when Mashiach comes, V'heshiv Lev Avos Albanim V'Lev Banim Al Avosam, that the hearts of the fathers will be returned by their sons, and the sons' hearts by their fathers. And Eliyahu can help facilitate, and he can help let us know that we've succeeded. But in the end, we are the ones that have to do tshuva. We are the ones who have to yearn for Mashiach every single day. We are the ones who have to fulfill our mission in life so that Eliyahu can fulfill his. That undrunk fifth cup of the coast, the fifth cup, Kosh El Eliyahu, that we have every year, that's a constant reminder to us that we still have work to do to fulfill our mission in life, to warrant Mashiach coming. So Bezrat Hashem, this crazy pandemic that we're experiencing, should be the beginning of the ultimate Geula, so that this year Pesach Eliyahu can come, and he'll be able to drink his cup, and tell us, Dayenu, it's time for Mashiach now. And then we'll no longer need to be alone without our parents, without our children, without our grandchildren, without our family, extended family and friends. V'heshiv lev avos albanim lev banim al avosam, both figuratively and physically, we will be able to return and be with our family celebrating the completion of our life mission with the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash Bezra Hashem Bekarov. Shavua Tov and a Chag Kasher V'Sameach.